Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening.
The big news that broke this week, thanks to Mike Dent, and that's MC Dent. He's a Apple technician, works for a service provider in Lancaster, United Kingdom. Thanks to our own Sam Valencia, and we kind of took two pieces of information and put them together, and we may have finally a solution to the mid-2011 mysterious 21.5 and 27-inch iMacs that do not work with solid-state drives. Sam, you finally did that 27.5-inch SSD swap out, right? And you had success initially, right?
Define success. I mean, we had some issues. We popped in the SSD and the adapter drive. We had failures right away where it wouldn't boot up fully. So we thought, all right. And I was concerned about doing it in the first place just because you guys scared the crap out of me with this model iMac. To go through it all, we basically had that newer tech adapter drive. We decided to move away from it and boot directly off the SSD, and it was working wonderfully. So then we thought we had a bad adapter. So I went over to Joe's office and I said, hey, you got any of these in stock? I need another one. So we grabbed another one, put that in, the computer booted, and we thought, okay, we just had a bad adapter drive. And within the hour, it kernel panicked, I think, 3 or 4 times. So then we just assumed, all right, this is it. It's the newer tech adapter drive. That's got to be it. So we took that out. Computer has been up for 3 days now without issue off of the Samsung Evo.
Nice.
Yeah, I must admit, initially when I had the feedback from you where you said it worked after you got the new one from Joe, I was kind of disappointed. And I thought,
me too. Like,
yeah. And then I was so happy to hear you had failure. Almost simultaneously, Mike Dent, who, by the way, works for UberTech in Lancaster, UK, reached out to us and he said, you know, we've been doing these and we have no problems. And he offered a picture. And I'm looking at his picture and he's not using the newer tech adapter drive. And in every single iMac upgrade that I've ever done, I've always used this adapter drive bracket. It's not only a holding bracket, but it's got some circuitry on it. And you can plug your SATA drive into that. And then you plug logic board cables for the SATA drive into the newer tech adapter drive. And that's the way you do it. Sam, you kind of tipped us off. And then Mike echoed back that they had no problems. So there's a very inexpensive mounting bracket that I guess is a little bit more widely available in the UK than it is here in the United States. If you try to get it from Amazon, it's a little expensive. But we did find a shop where you can order these from China. So they're about $4 a piece. So the three of us, Sam, Joe, and I, went in and we ordered a couple for each. But these are basically 2.5-inch size brackets that you could put in a standard iMac. You would simply use that coupled with the OWC cable, the appropriate temperature sensor cable. So you're not using any adapter drive, no circuitry from the adapter drive. And that seems to work with the mid-2011s.
Brilliant.
Unreal.
Yeah.
We never heard any feedback from anybody else up until Mike got back to us that, you know, no one had said they had problems or no one said they were successful. It was just radio silence. So this finally seems to solve the puzzle. But it's really weird that for some reason why those adapter drives don't work with that particular model iMac is still puzzling.
Just to be clear, he reached out independently. Like you didn't, I thought maybe you had reached out to him or something like that. But right around the time that I mentioned that we were okay without the adapter drive is when we got that message from Mike. So that just was very coincidental.
Yeah. Well, Mike had been listening to the show and
right. No, just the timing, like it was almost within the hour of me mentioning it. And we were just talking offline, so it was just funny that had happened at the same time.
Yeah, he posted the picture, yeah, almost simultaneously, so that was pretty cool.
It is very odd. I mean, I like you, Jerry, I've used that newer tech adapter drive in probably 99.9% of the iMac upgrades we've done over the years. Never had a problem as far as I know. I mean, I've certainly never encountered, like you guys have had, the 2011, I think it's the mid-2011 iMac that we've talked about repeatedly on the show, just basically simply not working. You know, I'm pretty sure I would have
would have known. I feel like maybe one got away, like, a, you know, we did an upgrade and it was good enough and it went out the door. It's like, we would have heard about it. It just, when it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Right. I mean, so it's just very strange that it has never happened to any of us at this point.
So that's exciting news. So thanks again, Mike. Really appreciate your input. Those brackets are soon to be arriving. Sam, right now you've got the thing taped down inside the iMac, or what does that look like?
We actually, what we did is we spun it around, the adaptive drive. So we just turned it the other way and bracketed it in that way until we get the new adapter. So it sits on there properly, but it's just not connected through the circuitry.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. And you don't want to do that because that costs $14 and you could save $10 and get this $4 bracket. We'll put all of this in our show notes, including, of course, the link to the OWC temperature sensor that's specially made for the 2011. You definitely have to use that, but you're good to go.
I got a quick thing. I was listening to the show from last week. We talked about rate structure, and it just occurred to me, you know, that we talked about raising the rate to, in order to basically then provide some room to discount the rate to clients who you have an ongoing relationship with. In at least in my methodology, I raise the rate so that, you know, again, like I said, I can discount it to the contract clients. And I think, Jerry, you were considering, like, basically raising the rate to select clients who, you know, you can provide a lot of value to, but there's no sort of ongoing relationship. So, you know, whether your rate is the same across the board, but then you raise it for those clients that don't sign up for your contract service or have an ongoing relationship with you, or you quote the higher rate and then you lower it, give a discount to the contract clients. It just occurs to me the limit there is raising the rate too much so that those one-off clients actually just don't call you back. Turn that knob too much and raise the rate too high, you risk the clients not actually following up with you to form that sort of ongoing relationship. So there's kind of a balance in there somewhere. I don't know how to strike that balance, but it just occurred to me that's the limitation there.
Yeah, that's a great point. And to quote numbers just a little bit for those of you who are listening and saying, like, well, what kind of numbers are you talking about? We're in New England and we're very close to New York City. And so there's a $200 threshold per hour that we're either pretty close, either over or under. And that's a tough one to break through. But that's essentially what Apple certified consultants in our area are charging. Closer you get to New York, the more you pay over the $200 mark. So you're right, Joe. After last week's show, I did go back and I did rethink that. My plan now, plan B, is to creep the rate up a little bit, push managed services with a buy-in for a minimum of 2 hours a month with a commitment of half a year. So a 2 hour a month minimum gets you the discounted rate, but you have to buy a total of 12 hours. So you have to be in for at least 6 months and then you get the discounted rate. And my discount was roughly 15%, which is an attractive discount and may in fact stimulate more business.
Yeah, that's a significant discount. I'm at 22%. Again, I raised my rates so much that I had that room to basically discount it. Conversely to my original point there, I haven't had a lot of pushback in raising the rate, you know, where I'm hearing from clients that it's too high and that they're not going to call me back and things like that. It does have some effect. Like, I think there are certain clients who would be calling more often, but who hold out and only call if they like have to, you know, because the rate has gone up. That is something to look out for. But I think it's a great way to incentivize your clients to sign on board with the managed services plans.
And for our listeners too, the area where Sam and Joe do business is affectionately referred to as the Gold Coast. So you figure it out.
Right. You're exactly right. I think the other part of that discussion too is we've spoken with some people over time that purposely raised that hourly rate very high because they wanted to discourage the hourly clients to come by. They only wanted projects or MSP stuff. So, I mean, I agree with what you guys are saying. You want to bring it up, but you don't want to alienate some of those people. But there have been people that think the other way because they say, I only want MSP. I don't want any of this hourly BS. And they jack it up so that it's unattractive to people.
Right. I think Luis Geraldo has mentioned that in the past. It just scares them off.
I was working late night, as I do for some of my clients, on their server so as not to interrupt their workday. And there's actually two pieces to this. One is the fact that I needed to get an app for them pretty urgently that night to do something. I didn't have their Apple ID, nor do I usually have a personal Apple ID information. This is a small office, so they don't have an institutional Apple ID. And anyway, long story short is I needed to get to them that night. So I just decided, oh, wait a second. I have the volume purchase program. What am I thinking? So it was kind of a neat little thing. I went into my VPP account. I ordered one copy of this app. You can do it so that it automatically embedded in your MDM solution, or you can download a code. And I didn't have to have purchase information for them, and we could just redeem it under their account. It was kind of a neat little way where we could not have to get authorization of a credit card for a client, but be able to use an app or download an app on the fly when we needed it. Which in turn brings me to this great little app called AutoMounter that I was using, because we had this client that, to give you the background story, they had a Mac Mini server for a long time. They needed an upgrade, and we pushed them towards a Synology because it was just a better fit for them. We didn't need to spend a lot of money on another external RAID with another Mac Mini server. So this is a husband and wife shop, two people. We threw in a Synology. We were going to enable the FTP service, and they had been using Rumpus all this time. And over the years, they developed a lot of users and people connected. And I just decided, you know what, it's already a big enough transition for them moving to this new box and showing them how it works. So we decided to let Rumpus be and simply leave Rumpus on the old server and mount the Synology as the Rumpus destination. So basically, Rumpus doesn't think any differently. It just says, here's my new root folder for everything. My users and groups, or my users and passwords, still exist, and nothing changes on the front end for the people that attach to it. Which was great, except this old Mac Mini server kept unmounting the Synology just randomly, periodically, here and there. That brings me to AutoMounter, which is what we use, which is a great little app, $7 app on the App Store. And it just simply is aware of any of your volumes mounted. And if it sees it go away, it just remounts it immediately, and no one has to do anything about it. So it was an awesome little solution for a great, just tiny pain in the butt problem.
That's a very cool tip.
Great tip. Purpose-built app for exactly the problem you're having. That's awesome.
Yeah, and I tested it out. It was awesome. I purposely ejected it, and it was like, boom, it was back up within like 5 seconds. I was like, wow, this is great.
That's wild.
Yeah, Rumpus is pretty good. We've done that in the past too, where we've got this educational institution and they use Rumpus for class assignments. And I had some time ago pointed it to the Synology, and it works very well. If you haven't taken a look at that, we suggest you check out Rumpus. It's a great all-purpose app. It's got a great web GUI and can serve up files for your clients to securely log in, whether they're on a local LAN or across the interwebs. We have one client who uses it, and we've got an SSL certificate, and they securely use it to watch video for their training sessions.
I dig Rumpus in a big way. So I was secretly, you know, happy to not have to move off of it just yet. Eventually we will, but I love Rumpus.
You guys know we are big fans of Status Board from Panic. It's been discontinued. We talked about it on a previous show, but, you know, we're going to use it as long as it lasts, I think. We have an iPad dedicated to that purpose, mounted on, on a wall in the office, essentially, and plugged in using the Apple Lightning to... I guess it's the Lightning AV adapter. It's got the HDMI port and, of course, a Lightning port to pass through power. Basically, it sits there and it's always on. We turn on and off the projector every day, but we just kind of leave the iPad where it is and it's just on. At some point, stopped charging. Well, it basically was off. I found it off and I tried to get it to turn back on. It wouldn't. I tried to charge it up. I found that it would charge when plugged into the 12-watt Apple USB power adapter, and it would charge just enough to turn on. And then when it would turn on, it would have like, you know, 2 to 5% or so battery, the base charge for it to just turn on. And then it would turn on and I'd like go to lock the screen or try to do anything. And it would basically just like power down immediately. So I'm pretty sure what was happening is it was like just drawing too much power. The other clue was that the power adapter it got really hot. The 12-watt Apple USB power adapter got really hot. Like hot to the touch. So I tried a different one. I just swapped it out. I figured that's the most likely solution. Second one had the same result, although it didn't immediately get super hot. It just wouldn't charge up properly. Even then, like, noticed a smell on the first one, like that distinct sort of electrical short smell. So we threw that one away. We just don't trust it anymore. But the best I can tell is the iPad was trying to draw too much power. And I thought, you know, well, maybe because it's just sort of powered on all the time, this charging circuit became less efficient or something, and it's just not keeping up with running and charging at the same time. So on a whim, I just thought, you know, I remember reading this tip at one point where we've got these new Apple USB-C power adapters. You know, it came with my MacBook Pro. I've got a couple extras on the bench here. And we even had an older one from the original MacBook, the little 12-inch MacBook, which is a 29-watt adapter. So I had my MacBook Pro 13-inch came with the 61-watt USB-C adapter. So I took that adapter out, and I had purchased from Apple this USB-C to Lightning cable to, in theory, you know, the idea is you charge your iPhone from your USB-C port on your Mac without a separate adapter, just this one cable. So the other thing you can do with that cable is you can plug in the USB-C end to like the Apple USB-C power adapter and the Lightning end to your device, and you can charge with more power. You can charge your iPad or your iPhone or whatever, any Lightning device. Figured, let's try it. You know, if it, maybe it needs more power. And sure enough, lo and behold, the 61-watt USB-C power adapter charged the iPad up. I could turn it on. I could even work on it. It stayed charging, you know, when I was working on it. It got up to 100% pretty quickly. Left it plugged in a while. It stayed, you know, kept that base charge, no problem. I plugged it back into the, you know, Lightning to HDMI adapter. Was able to charge through there as well. Our status board is back up and running. You have to spend a little bit on the power adapter and the cable, special cable, but it's cheaper than buying a new iPad. The thing I did after too, because I remembered that I had that 29-watt adapter that I bought back when the MacBook came out, and we started to see them on the bench here and there. Tracked that down, swapped out my 61-watt adapter for the 29-watt adapter, which I don't really have a use for. I don't have a MacBook. We've just got the 87-watt adapters on the bench for whatever model, you know, MacBook or new MacBook Pro come through. So I figured that was actually just like an extra adapter anyway. So I'm just using that now, and that works just as well as a 61-watt adapter did. Basically, $19 for the cable. I had the 29-watt adapter. It's still been holding up. I'm sort of doing the smell test every once in a while to make sure it's not like overheating or melting. The literal smell test. But yeah, it works. It works great. So just a little tip in case it happens to anybody else.
So a little bit earlier in the show, I had commented that Joe and Sam work on the Gold Coast. I work on the Coal Coast.
Coal Coast.
So things have been a little bit slow here in MacWorks land. I'm always thinking of unique ways to generate more work. So one of the things I've found that I've done in the recent past, and I've never mentioned it on the show, but it's worthy of mentioning, and it's an unsolicited plug for Watchman monitoring. We all have these tickets that come in from Watchman. I've got mine integrated with Zendesk, and they work great. We had a number of shows ago, J.D. Strong, on show number 157. It's called Watchman Monitoring and Zendesk Integration Getting Started. And J.D. is one of the experts on creating these unique macros for Zendesk. And you can bang out your tickets really fast to respond to clients with canned responses, provide them some useful information, and then keep your ticket in a pending status until it gets resolved. Well, often some of these tickets grow stale. And J.D.'s got some great techniques for refreshing some of those stale tickets and also retiring some of them. But what I tend to do, and this is only because I don't have dozens and dozens of tickets, is I blow them all up in Zendesk. And basically, I just go in and I delete all the tickets and I sit back and I go, okay, let's see what happens. And inevitably, I'll get fresh versions of these tickets come in. I'll reach out to my clients again. And 9 times out of 10, I'm able to create work for myself almost instantly, where the client will finally respond and say, yeah, sure, you know, we need you to come on site. Let's take care of that. Or how do we set up this remote session to resolve this issue that you've warned us about? It's just a great way to stir up the pot. So I just wanted to throw that out there. It's called blowing up your Zendesk.
Blowing up your Zendesk. That's a great technique. So it just basically starts, man, I need to do that. Something awful. I really need to do that. Blow up your tickets and then just like it starts fresh and you just respond to the new ones coming in.
Yeah, or Zendesk bankruptcy, you could call it.
Yes, exactly.
You know, there's that one little moment there where it reads like zero tickets and you feel like, ah, that looks so great, you know?
It doesn't last long.
It doesn't last long, no. But it's a great little tip. The other thing, completely unrelated, how many times have you ever been out at a client's site and are working on an Apple Mail issue with them and you quit Apple Mail and let's say they've got maybe 2, 3, 4 accounts. Maybe a lot of those accounts have lots and lots of mail in the database. And you launch Apple Mail, and it takes you a long time before you actually see the viewer window come up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've experienced that. We have an ongoing client that we provide support for. She doesn't have a lot of email accounts in play. She's only got 2, but they're on snet.net, which is the Southern New England telephone from up in this area. And that was one of the properties that was initially absorbed by, AT&T handles it And so does Yahoo. Yahoo delivers the mail. And we know how great Yahoo is. But she's literally got, without exaggeration, thousands and thousands of emails, and nothing is deleted. So this database store in Apple Mail is like a house of cards, and we've had to rebuild it over the years. I always tell her that I have some trepidation trying to resolve email problems with her, because it's like swatting a hornet's nest with a stick. You know, I just don't want to touch it. One of the things we did, you know, due diligence, was we went to go about changing our Yahoo passwords. We tried this about 45 days ago, found that the integration between AT&T and Yahoo wasn't in place. So you could change it on the AT&T side and that would work, and AT&T would recognize the new password. But then when you'd go to the mail component that's handled by Yahoo, it wouldn't work. It only would recognize the old password. The left hand was not talking to the right hand. And so we got on the phone and we finally got somebody from Yahoo support. And again, this goes back at least 45 days. And they said, yeah, we know about that, but we're having bigger problems, but we're going to get it all solved. So they did actually get it solved. So we went in and we changed her passwords. But then what we were finding was, and they did work and they integrated with Yahoo just fine. But then when we would input the password in Apple Mail, of course, when you're using a newer version of Apple Mail, it invokes the system preference pane where you've got the internet accounts. And that's where we were getting the pushback, where we were getting an error message. We'd put in the correct password in internet accounts, and the gear would spin for a little while, and then it would say that it was the incorrect password. And so this is really weird. You know, you do a lot of the troubleshooting things that you would normally do. Finally, I went into Keychain, and what I found was she had legacy entries for email accounts with older versions of the password. And they were just all sitting in the keychain, one on top of the other. I just blew them all out. I blew out every single instance of the incoming mail server and the outgoing SMTP server. I just blew them all out, set them up fresh. That resolved the problem. But the other remarkable thing that happened was when we'd open up Apple Mail would open up instantly. So we would see the viewer window as quickly as the app would launch. If you do notice that there is some hesitation in that viewer window, you definitely want to go into your keychain and see if you've got old legacy or repeated references to the same email account and get rid of them.
I can back you up there, Jerry, too. I've experienced that same thing, so I would agree with your assessment.
Well, speaking of houses of cards, I mean, that's that peek behind the curtain that you got there with the one password, you know, works one place and the old password works somewhere else. That's just the kind of security model where you're just, I mean, it just makes you wonder what's going on over there. Yahoo, I guess.
Bunch of Yahoos running Yahoo.
Right.
And they have so many properties, so many legacy properties that they've absorbed, all these different email addresses, millions of email accounts.
Right. Because we know because they've all been hacked, right? It's a list of all the, you know, individual email accounts and passwords out there on the internet. So you can easily verify our facts on this one.
Back, I think it was prior to Mountain Lion. I'm pretty sure about this, possibly even Lion. When a user account was at the lock screen, you had an option to change the name and enter admin credentials to get into their user session, as opposed to having to log into a separate user session. So if you needed to do something in their account and they had left for the day and the computer was locked, you had an option to do that. That went away. I don't know if you guys found methods around this, but we ended up a few years ago, and I had to make this change on a computer recently. I thought this would be great to bring up for the show. When that went away, it was a real big problem for a couple of my clients that I used to always go in late night, but we had their screens to automatically lock so that, you know, when a cleaning crew or other people would come around, they couldn't just get into their computers. So what we did was we found a method to edit a file in the Etsy directory. So and we'll put this in the show notes, but it's etsy/pam.d/screensaver. And in there is a field where you can change a parameter from required to sufficient so that when you go to a locked computer and you see it's waiting for their password, you can simply hit option return, put in the admin credentials, and get into their particular user session, which was a huge help for me at a couple of my clients. So I thought I'd mention that. I'll put the exact details in the show notes of what you need to change, but in case it would help anybody, I think it's a great little tip.
That is a good tip. And how long has that been in place?
yeah, since Mountain Lion, because I remember that's why I think it was Lion when this feature went away and we had to find a workaround in Mountain Lion. And it still works because I just tested it the other day.
That's wild. Yeah, I had forgotten about that feature. I remember it getting some criticism about how it's like insecure and this and that. But the idea is if you're an admin, you can pretty much do that anyway. I mean, you can just reset somebody's password, right? So it's right. Not exactly a security, you know, issue. It's like more of a like maybe kind of minor privacy benefit, you know, not to have that ability. But if you really want it in, you have the rights as an admin. So I guess, you know, what's the sense in taking that away? But I guess they did it for privacy. Maybe they got some bad press about it or something. And it's nice to know that there's just what it sounds essentially like a registry entry for
yeah,
getting
right.
it back. So that's, it. Yeah, that's all I know about Windows, by the way. That's the only thing I know.
the big bad registry. As an admin, like you said, you could reset passwords, but also you can invoke sudo and just do whatever you want under the hood anyway. So in my book, for what I need it for, I have all the power to do anything I want to their accounts either way. So why not just give myself an easier option to get into their accounts and make changes?
Right. Now, would you push that something like that out over ARD? Did you say the change in Etsy, I forget where you said it was?
I'm sure you could, but I have not. Ever since we discovered it, I think it was like 2013, it's been in place on those devices. So back then I didn't do it via ARD. I don't think I even knew how. And I'm sure you could at this point, but I haven't needed to.
Well, that is a good tip. Good to know it's there. I have a small tip that I discovered through Google. It was a classic. I'm online with the client. I'm connected remotely. So the issue was that Safari wasn't working. So the client email is saying, you know, Safari's not working on my MacBook. To clarify, you know, is internet working? Like, is your email working? Or does it seem like the internet's down? Because, you know, people say like Safari's not working. What they really mean is like their Wi-Fi is out in the whole house or something, you know. But in this case, she said, well, if you get this email, then email's working. So... And I'm like, I don't know what I'm facing here, but let's get connected remotely. She was out on the West Coast somewhere. The way I got connected remotely was we luckily already had TeamViewer on there. So that was the next clue that the internet was actually fine. I was able to connect remotely. And she didn't have any other web browsers there. I opened up Safari and it didn't actually open. The problem was you click on the icon and it just doesn't open. Doesn't say anything, doesn't give you an error, just doesn't open. There was an entry in the log, and I forget what it was, but I think that's how I stumbled into this solution. I Googled the error that was in the log. I came across an Apple Discussions forum post on it, and someone mentioned a similar problem, and theirs was actually an earlier, like it had been a few months prior, but luckily the solution was the same. So the solution that was recommended was reinstall the 2016-002 supplemental update. In fact, it was the latest one is the 003 update for, in her case, 10.11.6. And sure enough, I manually downloaded that from Apple's website and reinstalled it. And I think it required a reboot. And after rebooting, Safari worked. So that was it. Easy solution. I'm not sure. I think it was like either that she had previously tried to install that or had installed it and it resulted in an error. At some point it just stopped working, and that update in particular was a solution. So just in case you're having a weird, baffling issue with Safari not opening, you know, try reinstalling the latest security update.
That's a big old pain in the butt.
I mean, the remote made it interesting. Luckily, she had TeamViewer on there, quick support, so was able to get connected. And in fact, I actually transferred. I had to download Firefox disk image to my machine. And then use TeamViewer's file transfer to send it over to her because I had really no other way of, you know, I could have used like the curl command on the command line, I guess, like download the Firefox installer. I needed a way basically to download an Apple security update. I may have had other options, but that was the easiest way. And luckily, TeamViewer's file transfer has actually gotten much better lately. It's decently, I don't know if I'd call it fast. I mean, it's fast enough for something like this. It used to be really excruciatingly slow, but it's gotten a lot better.
I would agree on that note. Well, a lot of features of TeamViewer, just the scrolling alone has made my life a lot easier with TeamViewer improving that feature.
For sure.
So just prior to the show starting, speaking of browser issues, I had stumbled at a web page and the URL was something to the effect like apple.com-supportcenter.host. It looked like it was an Apple site and it says your system is infected and there's an Apple Care Protection Plan logo and system damage is at 28% and immediate removal is required. So with no hesitation, I pressed the button that said scan now. And sure enough, it's our friends at MacKeeper that are pulling these like incredible shenanigans, but this is one of the best ones I've seen so far. I'll share it with you guys and I'll share it with our listeners. It's pretty funny, but something also to keep an eye out for. Either one of you guys had any experience with Little Flocker? Are you familiar with this piece of software?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so this looks for a ransomware, spyware, misbehaving applications, and it runs almost like Little Snitch. Little Flocker was written by Jonathan Sadarsky. He's a security expert, and he has a blog, and he's very, very well respected in the industry, and he makes this application. So if you haven't checked it out, it's just worthy of at least kicking the tires and maybe considering it for maybe you've got some clients out in the field that are always getting infected, and they really need some industrial strength blocking because they're prone to clicking on things. So I just thought I would throw that out there and mention it.
Matt Keeper, I find the whole thing baffling to me because, like you said, I mean, they're involved in all these shenanigans all the time, and yet they sort of purport to be like a reputable company, and you know, they offer their software for sale, and if you go to uninstall it, they're like, why are you uninstalling us? What did we do? Is too much advertising? Yes, you're a scam. It's like, how else do I have to put this? I mean, it's just strange that they try to walk this line between being like legit software and just using these like fear, uncertainty, and doubt, certainly scare tactics, but just outright scams like you're describing. It's just, I don't know, I find it so bothersome.
Yeah, it's infuriating.
Well, one of the reasons why I like doing a live show is because you can do in-show updates. So, you know, it took me long enough to talk about what I consider to be this awesome option return feature. And as I'm looking in the chat, Kevin Ginger posted, first he was really excited about it, and then he posted an article from Jamf Nation saying it seems to be broken in Sierra. So I'm really disappointed to see that. I haven't tested it myself, but Jamf Nation is always a good resource of people that kick around this information. So I'll confirm it on my end, but if that's true and maybe it's gone away, that's a total freaking bummer for me. So I'll post some kind of update in the next show and we'll see what we find.
So I want to reach out to our listeners and maybe any iPhone experts out there. I've got an iPhone Plus, so this is one that's 2 years old. One of the features that I use all the time is I tap on an application and I pull it down so it reveals the search bar. And I would assume this is doing a total phone spotlight search. I guess that's what Apple would call it. What'll happen is I'll frequently want to get to an app that way. If I type in, for instance, something like Evernote, what happens is the screen goes absolutely blank. The app won't come up immediately like you would normally expect it to be. It's blank. I could see the shaded desktop behind it. And then it waits and waits. And finally, it brings me an option to search at the App Store. I tap on the App Store. The App Store recognizes that the app's installed. And then I go to open. So this is an incredible time suck. Pull down on an app. I try to do a search. And I put an app that's on my phone. And the phone takes 45 seconds, 60 seconds to find it. Or it just dumps me into the App Store. Here's the fix. If I go to languages and I change the language, I think Springboard relaunches. So I will go like Australian English. Phone comes back up and then I try to do the search. The search is instantaneous. And then it's fine for a little while, maybe a day or two, and then it's back to its old shenanigans again. So I'm constantly refreshing the language on the phone. So if anybody knows what's going on with this or some fix that can definitely put an end to it, I would really appreciate it. Just write in and send us an email. That'd be great.
Yeah, that's one of those frustrating things about troubleshooting on the iPhone, because on the Mac, you know, we have tools for that. Rebuilding Spotlight, you know, things like that. But on the iPhone, I don't know if you can even do such a thing as rebuilding Spotlight without, like, I guess probably restoring from backup, right?
I would imagine so. I did talk to a genius at the Apple Store as early as today, and they're like, well, we've never seen that before. And I showed him, and he's like, huh. And then I said, well, what if I reformatted the phone? And like you said, Joe, and restore from backup, because, nah, that usually doesn't work. So
really?
He said, but tell us. We'd like to report that in and escalate it. You know, and I've got a two-year-old phone, and I'm like, nah, never mind. Just leave me alone.
You know, something I haven't messed with, but I'd be curious to see what's happening on your phone during that, is we were talking about console and how it's rewritten and it's changed a lot. And one of the good new features of it, I think there are a lot of cool new features. Let me not talk negatively about the changes, but is if you plug in an iOS device or something, it can give you the logs of that device as well. Yeah, I wonder if that'll, who knows? It could be crap that might not help you. But if you have a look, I wonder what you'd find out of that when you try and do those searches.
That's a great point. And how do you get there for all of those folks at home that don't know? Because, of course, I know.
You can just – I think you should just use the console app and plug in your device via USB. And you should be able to grab from the sidebar, as far as I understand it.
Very cool. Well, I'll try that.
I was at a client, and I'm trying to think of who their ISP was. And I meant to talk about how pretty cool this client was. And this client I just picked up has an old a converted synagogue in New York City. He owns the whole building, and that's now his workspace. He's a photographer, and his living space down on the bottom floors. And it's an amazing setup. That's pretty fascinating. But anyway, I was there. We were doing a whole bunch of stuff. I came and begin. There's not enough time at the end of this show to talk about all the things that were going on there, which we ended up fixing a lot of. But I had an issue on my computer that seemed familiar to me, but I couldn't remember why it happened. I was on his network. I was working away. I was doing stuff. We were actually correcting some network issues with the wrong DHCP scheme and devices on static. Finishing up and attempting to leave, I noticed I couldn't get online. So I thought, is his wireless network down? Did I do something wrong before? You know, of course, the worst things happens right when you're ready to go. We tested all his devices and they can get online. And I was in a hurry to get out. So I said, okay, I'll figure this out on my computer when I get home. And when I got home, I could not get online either. Check DNS. In fact, I went into my network settings and I was still set to DHCP, but I had DNS entries, manual DNS entries on my computer. 192.18.0.1 and .2. That I obviously did not put them there. I did not even mess with my computer troubleshooting-wise while I was there, but I had manual DNS entries in my DHCP settings on my Mac. Have either of you guys ever seen anything like that?
Yes, I have. That router is hacked. We saw this in an attorney's firm.
Okay, you did mention something about a hacked router. So this was not too long ago that you mentioned that, right, Jerry?
Yeah, just right before the new year.
It's good to see I pay attention. So you found similar issues, like a similar set of IPs?
Yep.
Wow, unbelievable. See, I figured I should know this, and that's why I asked you guys. Not great for them, so now I got to reach out to that client and be like, dude, we got an issue here. He is switching ISPs because he's getting horrible speeds, but I mean, this is a more immediate issue until the switch occurs.
That could be why he's getting horrible speeds, though, too.
Excellent point, too.
There's a redirect that's going on there, obviously, and you know, you're going through Bulgaria.
You know, it's funny that because he's been troubleshooting with this ISP for the last couple of weeks, that he eventually called us in for internal network issues. I didn't even see that coming. So thank you, Jerry. I knew someone here would have the answer, so I'm going to reach back out to the client and let you guys know what happens from there.
But why would the entry still be in your Mac after you got back and like connected to your network? Presumably your network is sending out DHCP as well. So wouldn't it have overridden whatever the previous DHCP, you know, provided DNS servers were?
It doesn't. Well, manual entry always takes precedent.
Right, exactly. So the manual entries are there. So I had to remove them before it would accept DNS from DHCP.
Okay, right. And you mentioned manual, but then why? Then how are manual DNS entries on your Mac coming from the router?
I don't know how. I just know that Jerry is right.
I'm not questioning Jerry, but I'm just curious. So because it just seems like, you know, like a hacked router shouldn't be able to do that. I mean, it can send out DHCP, but it can't send out like permanent manual DNS entries. I mean, I guess it can, but I just don't understand how.
I don't either. That's why I was totally and completely confused. And, you know, it's again one of those situations where you're running out the door and I'll figure it out later. The issue wasn't on his devices. He was getting online with all of them. So that's the other weird piece is when I looked at his devices, they did not have this manual DNS entry. And it was just me. Like, I don't know.
Well, that's so strange. No, that should populate across his network.
One of the reasons why I was there, he reset his Airport Extreme. It started handing out different DHCP 10.1.0 addressing, and all of his network devices, the static devices, were 192s. And he had no idea why this was happening. So that's why we were originally called in. And that was like a 5-minute fix. I ended up doing some other stuff there. But when we looked at the network settings on the other devices, we did not see those manual entries there.
Is it possible you picked this up from another client and that actually is, because that would be one of the things that would reaffirm that it was coming from his router, is that it would be on his devices.
That morning I left the house, I was working fine. When I left his location, which was my only stop of the day, is when this happened.
Okay. This is why we tune in.
I think you might have been hacked, Sam. I think maybe you've got Matt Keeper on there or something.
You know, I noticed this little helmet icon in my menu bar. I wasn't sure what to do about it.
If it wants you to run a scan, you've got to run that scan as soon as possible.
Uncle Jimmy's search bar.
Exactly. Well, before we end the show, I wanted to just give a big shout out to our Patreon sponsors and supporters. Just want to mention specifically the ones who pledge at the level where you get to hear your name on the broadcast live every month. We really appreciate you and everyone else. Jonathan Spiva of 74-Bit, JD Strong of course, Strong Solutions, Spokane Mac, Daniel Escobar of Proactex, Tom Bridge, Tim Nyberg at the Mac Guys, Weldon Dodd, Jonathan Nieves of Exceed Technology Group, Dennis Nolan of Cirrus Partners. We really appreciate your support. And everyone else who pledges, who chooses to remain anonymous, we really, really appreciate it. And we'd certainly love to have you as a patron of our show. Go to commandcontrolpower.com and click on support to become a Patreon sponsor and supporter of the show. We really appreciate all your support. Thanks again for sponsoring Command Control Power.
Rosebud. I just gotta get the two hard-boiled eggs out of the freezer. I'll be right back.
All right. Nice.
All right.
I think my iMac just froze when I tried to stop the broadcast. Are we still on here?
Probably are.
Yeah. Wow. I know you didn't want to hear login window follow up, Jerry, but
we're gonna be stuck on the air forever.
Yeah. Exactly. I lost access to my iMac here. I lost ARD access to it. So
it's like a Doctor Who episode or something like that, you know, where we're just stuck on the air.
We're still in a filibuster.
Until next month.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we were still recording, this would be good. This is
I
the after
we might
show.
Be. I think it just like, I don't know, because I can still hear you guys. So I think it's still working.
Try command control power.
Yeah, really. I know. Right.
Are we off the air?
No, nope. No, we're still on the air. I need to like probably hard shut down my iMac and hope that the recording survives, basically, is the only thing I can do. I don't know, guys. This
oh, that's wonderful.
Before. I know. I've got a black screen of death on my iMac. I guess
who's still in the chat room? Who's deliciously listening in the chat room?
People are hanging out for the good stuff, man.
This is the good stuff. They're just waiting for us to like go off the rails and start swearing and stuff, I think.
You need to SSH into that computer, save the file, copy it over, and then
we can
yank the power cord.
Live troubleshooting here. Actually, I might. I wonder if I have remote login on that machine. I think I do.
Did you scan?
I did. Yeah, I did. It says my Mac is heavily damaged. 33.2%. Please download the Mac Keeper application to remove 3 viruses from your Mac.
See, the thing is, I'm blaming Mac Keeper, but I also think that they're not doing this. Like, basically, people are trying to trick other people into downloading Mac Keeper, and then they get some kind of referral credit or something. So it's thanks to like the probably really bad, poorly designed incentive structure of Mac Keeper's like marketing plan. But I'm wondering if this is actually like put out by Mac Keeper or just hosted by some other company that just wants to get Mac Keeper installs, you know, and they get credit for if they buy, I guess, something like that.
Yeah, that is possible. I mean, so you're defending Mac Keeper.
Yeah, I guess I am. I'm a big
defender. You're like the Mac defender.
I'm the Mac defender, exactly. That was a virus, right? Wasn't that a famous?
No, that was another one. That was like Mac Keeper. Yeah. It's called Mac Defender. Wow. Bring back Mac Defender.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we should have for the ACES conference. We should have a t-shirt. Oh, it'd be so awesome. And we got to have like our sponsors to be like Mac Defender with the shield on right. It and then Mac Keeper on the other sleeve.
That'd be amazing. We got to see if
we could do that. It'd be a special edition ACES t-shirt that you could still order it for the show. But if you're at ACES, you'll get it first. If there's anybody with really good artwork chops to give us camera ready artwork for the t-shirt company, you know what you have to do. Make sure the kids are safe. Yeah,
did you finish the eggs, Jerry?
I got to tell you about my egg thing. Stand by. I'll be right back.
Standing by for the great egg story.
Oh, man. All right. I'm trying to SSH in here.
Yeah, so Brian wants the egg story.
We all want the egg story, Jerry.
Still online?
Crap.
Yeah.
All right. So Joe's going like, crap.
No, I mean, we're like hanging on by a thread. Like Skype is still running in a machine that has like a black screen and I cannot get into. I'm SSH'd in. I don't know what to do. Cause like, what am I supposed to do? I guess I could.
That's because you got that low rent setup over there. You got that white iMac, the G4 iMac that you're broadcasting from. And you've got some sort of alternate monitor hooked up to it. I mean, it's real.
It's an Intel Core Duo. No, it's true. Oh,
excuse me. You know, we're vegetarian here, right? We eat eggs because that's one of the things vegetarians do. We're not vegan. We're just vegetarian for protein. There's this fantastic egg cooker, and there's a number of them on Amazon. So I'm going to get you the one that I got. It was less than $20. It's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. You can make a soft boiled egg in 7 minutes. It makes poached eggs. It makes omelets. You can do up 6 eggs at one time. It's the Dash Go Rapid Egg Cooker.
When did we become QVC? What's going on here?
And it's $19 and it's fantastic.